you relapsed in August 18. Take us to that. And what do we mean by relapse?
Okay, so I suppose it's I got what I asked for, really, in some ways. So after I finished the 2 years of monotherapy, we thought that would be me clear for a couple of years and I wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. The consultant said to me, you know, we should think about having a scan just to make sure that everything's okay. And I just flippantly said, if cancer is able to survive what it's had over the last, you know, two plus years at that point, then good luck to it. I think sadly it was listening, because a month later I was on a train to Scotland to go to a party, and I just got up out of my seat and I felt pain in my knee, and I just thought, crap, that's cancer pain. So I knew at that point on my way up to Aberdeenshire that cancer had come back. So all credit to the NHS and UCLH. I called them up on Monday morning. This was on a Friday afternoon, late evening, when I discovered this pain. I called them up on the Monday and said, I've got these types of symptoms. Can I get in for a scan, please? They organised it the next day and I had the results by Thursday. So it was super quick. They were really, really efficient. But one of the things I think pick up on a point before is just people don't tell you what's going on. They dress up language. So no one actually used the word relapse when I had relapsed. They said, yeah, we're going to take you back into treatment. We're going to do this, this and this.
We don't want bullshit.
Well, no, we don't want bullshit. We want clear language that we can understand. And he gave me this treatment regime, started filling out the form. And I said, hang on a second. I've had over 2.5 years of X drug, and you want to give it back to me? Surely we don't, you know, surely by now we think it doesn't actually work. At which point he said, well, actually, that's a good point. Well, thanks very much. So now I have to play consultant to my own health because you haven't bothered to read my notes. Then he gave me a different treatment regime, which he didn't have time to think about, to look at what was going on in my body, to work out what might be the right regime for me. So I had to sign to do the next best thing, and off I went.
Just jumping in there, the importance of actually not always settling for what a consultant or a doctor tells you, questioning something. We can politely question if you're not certain or you think something could be done, or ask why it's being done. Is that something you've seen?
I do it all the time. I'm a real thorn for this, and a positive thorn for this. So, for example, the fertility issue. I didn't want children at the time, and I was single at the time, so that it wasn't in my intent or even thinking about it. It's too much having too much fun. And a friend said to me, you need to think about fertility. So it wasn't even a doctor. It was a friend that said to me, you need to think about fertility. And when I spoke to the consultant about it, she was horrified. What do you mean you want to think about fertility? You've got a really serious condition. We need to get on top of it. But thankfully, my professor said, give her one month's go. And they were able to harvest 14 eggs.
Eggs, that's brilliant.
In that time, which is incredible. And again, the NHS.
The quality of the eggs.
They were good quality eggs, yeah.
And that's after chemo.
So this is before the chemo.
Oh, sort of brilliant. Yeah, so before
so we
chemotherapy.
Did it before all of that, yeah.
You then, what's it called, down reg or whatever, and then you take.
Then, yeah, so basically, it was a case of challenging the consultant who said, you know, absolutely not, you're barking mad.
Yeah.
To have that professor's view who said, yes, we'll give you 1 month's crack. And to be fair, the NHS were incredible. They fast-tracked me through everything. I was literally full of needles, full of drugs, mixing my own stuff and potions and, and getting these eggs at the end of the month. It was wonderful. And Mel over at the Garrett, it was just phenomenal lady.
So the IVF except the implants, not
there. Yeah, and they did it all without the funding being in place as well. So they're willing to take the risk on the funding coming into place after they started all this process and procedure. So they were fantastic. But that was my first challenge to them. My second one was when it came down to the original treatment, they wanted to do radiotherapy to my leg. And I said, you know, what are the side effects of this? And they said, it will destroy your leg. And I said, well, characterise, destroy, and said, you'll have no function. I said, hey, I'm a soldier in the British Army. I can't afford to have no function in my leg. I'm a soldier. I need to have function in my leg, so find a different route. So they went off, they gave me a different route. So that was another challenge. And then the third challenge was, again, after relapse, where they weren't to give me treatment, which clearly did not work. So, yeah, I think as a patient, you've absolutely got to take ownership because no one else is going to do it for you. You're one patient of many. And it's not a criticism of a particular consultant. It's the fact that it's a very, very busy NHS.
Yeah.
And no one knows you like you. So be your own ambassador, I think.
I was sleeping horrifically, so nothing stops me going to sleep. You know, I get blow darted at 2200 every night and I'm out for the count, no matter where I am or what I'm doing. But I'd be a 0-3 waker-upper, stressor, writing things down, thinking about what I've got to do, reading social media, thinking about the next tweet, all this sort of stuff. He picked up on that and asked me a few other questions. But anyway, the conversation went on and I just broke down with the doctor, like properly broke down and squealed like I'd never cried and squealed since I was probably 6 or 7 years old. And it's almost like everything was just pent up inside me, waiting to get out. And he, because he's a brilliant doctor, he just got it out of me. And yeah, it was a tough time. It's tough when you pride yourself on being somebody who you think you are to then be seen like that by a doctor and then to share everything with them was just a bit of a challenge. And then to then, you know, share that with my wife and my family as well was a tough pill to swallow.
Mm. Was you diagnosed with anything?
Yeah, it was depression, stress, sort of related stuff. And I was offered meds, which it was almost like a release as well. Once it happened, I was kind of over the moon it had happened. I didn't know it was there and I didn't know I wanted to release it, but when I released it, it was just an amazing feeling. And then I got put on some meds, not for overly long. I was recommended to do counselling, which I refused. I didn't want to do it because there was still an element in me that said, I don't need it. Mm. I'll be fine now I know what's wrong and now I've got some medication and now I've got a doctor to talk to who was absolutely brilliant and I confided in for the months afterwards. It all worked out okay. Mm. And from that, it just changed my mindset. Completely. It changed me as a human being. It's made me do things now I never would have thought I'd do. And it's made me want to help other people that are perhaps in the same position.
Mm. The next role on from that, so you handed over that role of Army Sergeant Major,
yeah,
and you became the Senior Enlisted Advisor. So essentially you're working now with and for the MOD.
Yeah.
You're removed from the Army as such. And we're looking at things like recruitment and retention and retirement. And I know that's a big part of what you're trying to go into there. But off the back of that, the mental health champion has come about.
Yeah.
That it's a new role, certainly seen by many as progressive and a really good step forward from and then with words and phrases like mental resilience that have crept in over the years and mental fitness. And an onus on management of good mental health. What is the role, firstly, of the kind of the Senior Enlisted Advisor, and then your kind of sub role as the mental health champion?
Yeah, so the Senior Enlisted Advisor to the Chiefs of Staff Committee. I mean, it's a long winded title, but I think it's a good thing that it's not called Defence Sergeant Major or Defence Warrant Officer, because as soon as you use words like that, you think of a shouty bloke with a stick that's telling people to pick up rubbish or sort out car parking. So I think Senior Enlisted Advisor to the Chiefs of Staff Committee is good. And so in the role, I advise the Chief of Defence Staff, Chief Defence People, Defence Ministers, and the Service Chiefs, with the help of the service warrant officers as well. So it's a pretty widespread sort of job. I do advise. I do pretty much, it's just a bigger scale of the Army Sergeant Major job, but I've got the other services to think about as well. So because I know the Army intimately, I've kind of stayed away from the Army for the last sort of 8 months of getting into this job, and I've learned a huge amount from the Navy and the Royal Air Force and the civil service. And there is, honestly, there is so much good stuff in each service that we could learn from each other. And I see the SEAC role, and that's the abbreviation for the job, the SEAC, as one of the only people that can get around about the whole of defence and try and bring the cloths of defence together with good ideas and share experiences. So I work out of the Ministry of Defence in London. I travel a lot and get out and about and try and learn as much as I can about the services. But essentially, many people have heard me say this before, I try to be three things, and that's a thermometer to check the temperature. And, you know, the way of life around defence. I'm a translator because I try and translate the language from the very senior levels all the way down to a language that you and I understand, normal human beings speak. And I'm a courier because I can deliver from the very senior levels right down to the most junior and then back up from the junior up to the senior. So it's a unique role. And I use social media heavily to try and do that and to try and message and to try and bring those cloths of defence together. And I work very closely with the service warrant officers because the Army, the Navy, the Air Force and the Marines have each got their own senior warrant officer that do most of the work with their own networks, and they feed that into me, and I use the information from the very lowest levels and feed it all the way up to the top. So, you know, people, again, there was naysayers, blockers, non-believers, people that felt threatened and jealous, but now it's in 8 months in, people have seen a difference already. And the mental health and wellbeing champion was just an idea. I happened to speak to a few people and said, I kind of can't believe that the military haven't got a champion. And when I say champion, I don't, you know, I'm no doctor. I'm no expert in mental health, far from it. And, you know, what's really triggered this is my own experience that we've just talked through, made me just want to do something and try and help people. That's literally what I'm trying to do in all of these roles. This isn't about, genuinely isn't about Glenn Horton. I've got nowhere else to go. This isn't about a hidden agenda. It's about these roles helping the people that they serve. Mm. And that's what it's about. And the Mental Health and Wellbeing Champion is literally there to raise awareness, to break down barriers, to break down the stigma, to signpost people, to let people know it's all right to talk. And if someone that's 6'4", looks like me with a bald head and tattoos and, you know, thinks they're the alpha male, it can happen to anybody. And it's my job to convince them it's okay to share and to talk. And then there is somewhere for them to go to help them.
He was really, really, really supportive. He sent me a lovely message, though, and it basically explained about, like, me pushing me towards therapy. Because in my head, I was thinking, I don't need therapy. I've, like, this. These are things that have happened. I've been out the army now for about 4 or 5 years. I've got businesses. I've got a beautiful, like, missus and a lovely daughter. I've got loads of support around the family. And I was thinking, I don't need therapy, but I was suffering really bad. My aunt, who said to you about slicing her wrist, she had died in October last year. And I'd carried the coffin. Bearing in mind, I really didn't want to at the time because I still resented it from all the hate that we got from as children. I started having nightmares that I would be lying in bed. I'd have my little baby girl in my arms and she'd be opposite, stabbing herself in like a chest and stuff. So it was really warping my memories. There was loads of other vicious nightmares of being chased. And if girls had really come and got a grip of me, and you know, before Christmas I found myself down the docks in Birkenhead, which was a good distance away from my house really, and it was winter, obviously freezing cold. If they fell in or jumped in, you wouldn't get out of there. There's not a chance. Loads of people have died in the same location. And I remember phoning my partner Nick, and I was like, if she answers, I'll be alright. If she doesn't, I'm going to go in. And that sort of, like, shock reality. Bear in mind, she never answers the phone, you know yourself. She doesn't have it with her. So, like, so it, the odds of her doing it was very, very limited at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
She answered and come and pick me up straight away. Now, I was in, like, the worst place that I can ever remember. And mentally, this had just popped up on me. Like, there was no warning signs. Years ago, I used to get angry. This made me really timid, made me go inside myself and really worry about, like, what people thought about me. I was getting anxiety was kicking in. So it was a complete spin from the old aggressive, like people can go, my mum would notice things and go, you know, calm down.
Mm.
You're snapping a little bit. Are you all right? No one asked me, was I all right? Because I come into myself and no one could see that there was a problem. So it was a completely different symptom that I hadn't seen before. And I nearly, you know, I was about to take my own life. And I still think now, if it weren't for the podcast, certainly number four and Wisey, I would have killed myself.